Hello, I'm Natalie Turvey, President and Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our final CJFJ talk of this season. We hope you enjoyed the series, even in two dimensions. We'll be back in the fall with a new season of talks on the future of journalism, and we look forward to the day when we can be together again. These important conversations are made possible thanks to the generosity of our exclusive JTalk series sponsor, TD Bank Group, and our thanks also to our in-kind supporter, Cision. During these complex times, the news industry needs like-minded support more than ever. If you'd like to support the work of the CJF, you can make a donation now by following the link below, or you can find out more at any time on the CJF website. And if you'd like to tweet about today's conversation, our hashtag is JTalksLive. Before we break for the season, we do have two upcoming special events. On June 9th, we hope you'll join us for the annual CJF Awards, celebrating journalism's champions of truth with our hosts Eric McCormack and Janella Massa. The evening honors the best in national and regional journalism and features new awards for climate solutions reporting, news innovation, and three inaugural fellowships for promising Black journalists. And on June 10th, join us for a special presentation featuring back-to-back conversations with CJF Tribute honorees, the Globe and Mail's Andre Picard, and CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta on their new books and uncovering COVID-19. They will be in conversation with last year's Tribute recipient and our host today, Anna Maria Tremonti. You can visit our website for details on how you can tune in. Our guest today is David Remnick, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and editor of The New Yorker, the legacy publication that is the gold standard in long-form journalism. David Remnick has been in charge since 1998, leading one of the most iconic publications in media through a revolutionary time in journalism, while keeping its journalistic and literary values alive and well. We're honored to have him with us to share his thoughts on the magazine's magic formula and hear his views on where journalism is heading. It is my great pleasure to welcome Anna Maria Tremonti in conversation with David Remnick.
Hello, David. So great to have you with us.
Thank you, Natalie.
David, I think I speak for a lot of us when I say the real attraction of The New Yorker is the long form journalism, but not solely the long form, but the longevity of the long form. The fact that we can get it the minute we get it, either on our phones or computers or in our mailbox, or whether 18 months later and we're in someone's guest room, remember those?
We're
reading it and it's still relevant and it's telling us something that we didn't know we wanted to know. So I want to start there. Help us understand the process that allows you to do that on such a consistent basis.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be, if we can say here, I'm delighted to be here and among my colleagues in Canada. I think that Harold Ross, who started the magazine with the help of some other people 96 years ago, had a kind of crazy idea. You know, newspapers in those days were duller than they are now. They were much more, they were just drier in their approach. If you were to read a copy of the New York Times in 1925, it had all the prose lift of a shipping report or a grocery list. It was very, very dry. And I think those original editors saw an opportunity to have more than length voice in journalism, people point of view, the kind of detail that you're more used to seeing in fiction than in nonfiction and all the rest. Length came with time. In the earliest New Yorker's profiles, you'll be surprised to know, and maybe you'll be nostalgic for it, were just a couple of pages long. Length came, developed over time, and I hear all the time about the New Yorker. Well, I love those long articles and long, and then they mount up on my coffee table. And I there's no question that we do publish pieces of great depth and detail. But I do hope that in each issue and each day, that we also provide things that are maybe shorter, and maybe in the end, possibly even a little bit more disposable. So that when you confront an issue of the New Yorker digitally or in print, that there's some sense of variety, that that while there might be a 15,000 word piece as there was last week on, of all things, UFOs, there's also a short piece on the political crisis of the day by, Steve Collar, whomever. There has to be some variety. Otherwise, people are going to admire the magazine more than they read it, and that would be a problem.
Well, and you do have that balance, and I've watched the magazine pivot as the technology has allowed more mm-hmm. digital offerings and the ability. I mean, you're podcasting, you're doing all sorts of things.
Right.
So I'm curious about the process that makes you say, you know, we're going to, and I have also seen you, obviously, you do the big stories on things that are happening right away. Look at the murder of George Floyd. Look at the Donald Trump things. But what makes you say, that one, I will wait 6 months for that one. And that one, I need it yesterday.
Yeah, well, part of it is about the obsession of writers. The New Yorker is I'm the editor, and I have colleagues who are editors. But unlike some other publications, the editor is there to discover what the obsession of an individual writer is so that he or she can follow that obsession to its proper end. And whether that means something that's a kind of standard investigative piece like Jane Mayer on campaign finance or Ronan Farrow on Me Too, or it's something a bit more unusual and unexpected, that hardly matters. I don't want to be a fake New York Times. It's the job of the New York Times or the LA Times or the Washington Post or Globe and Mail or whatever it might be, to be themselves. It's the job of the New Yorker to fulfill its mission and its values to their proper end. And so that means being funny. It means giving writers the leeway to have voice and even opinion. The rules of the game are different. We're committed to accuracy in an extreme way, almost a fanatical way. But we're also committed to freedom. We're committed to creativity, not only in the fiction we publish, but in the nonfiction that we publish, all within the bounds of fact. And I want every issue of The New Yorker to be, we covered Trump a lot, as we should, and everything that grew out of it. You know, we can discuss that. But I also want you to be surprised. I want you to pick up a magazine and say, I just wouldn't have imagined that this week I'd be reading about X, Y, or Z. That's part of the formula. That's part of the values of the place.
And from what I'm understanding from you is when you say that it's the job of the editor to discover the obsession of your writers, that they are also surprising you. So sometimes their obsession may not be something that you thought you wanted.
All the time. I think that's absolutely true. We have things that resemble standard editorial practice at publications that I'm sure everybody here has participated in one way or another. Ideas meetings, scheduling meetings, all these fairly conventional things. But at the end of the day, the good stuff comes from writers saying, I'm obsessed with this person, this situation, this geography, this problem. And for an editor, having the good sense to say yes, because editors are not traveling in the same way. They don't read in the same way. They're reading widely. Writers are very often reading deeply into one thing. I can't know what they're going to come up with, what thrilling thing that they'll come up with. And it would be the height of presumption or even arrogance for me to direct a writer too much. Now, sometimes pieces end up in the magazine that were originally an editor's idea presented to a writer, but the writer has to say yes. I'm not forcing any writers to do things because then the result is mediocre, usually, often.
No, and that kind of heavy hand would in the end end up calcifying the publication.
I think in our case, yes. But I also spent 10 years at the Washington Post, and I understand the need for a national editor saying, you know, so-and-so, you're at the White House today, you've got to cover such and such a speech. We need a news analysis on U.S.-Canada relations, or whatever it might be. There's that need, too. I don't underestimate it, but we just, you know, we're on Earth to do a slightly different thing or a completely different thing.
So talk to me a little bit about how you're processing, as editor, this moment in time from the racial the racial reckoning across North America, both in our society and in our journalism, to the political whiplash that was unleashed by the presidency of Donald Trump. And like, I know that's a lot, but that's been what you have been having to think about as well in the shaping of the magazine.
Well, I think it's not just for journalists. I think it's as human beings. As human beings, you know, we are living through a moment of neo-authoritarianism and anti-democratic political impulses that did not begin with Donald Trump, and they don't end with Donald Trump if he in fact is at an end. We're dealing with a global pandemic that may be easing in much of the United States, God willing, and Canada. But now we see its eruption in, one would have thought it would have happened earlier, in India and sub-Saharan Africa. And you can almost predict in you know, highly populated, dense places in Southeast Asia, wherever it might be. And it happened later because those populations tend to be younger, and for other reasons. And you're right, the global, the racial uprising is an extremely serious thing. In fact, my colleague Jelani Cobb and I is to react to that, have, you know, compiled this big anthology called The Matter of Black Lives, which will be out in September, which is writings about race in The New Yorker, beginning with James Baldwin, and before too, but the centerpiece in the beginning is James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. And, you know, and a million other issues. And yet I don't want to turn The New Yorker into only that, which is to say, like the higher Time magazine somehow, or Newsweek back in the 50s or 60s. We want to be ourselves. So over time, we have to get to all these problems, whether it's the Middle East today or all kinds of things. There needs to be some sense of variety, but also a sense of responsibility to these immense issues. And look, I'm sitting here at my desk in my apartment. I have a little microphone to the left of the computer where I do the radio hour, the New Yorker radio hour, which you can get on our website or podcast form if it doesn't reach you in terrestrial form. I have meetings like we're talking now endlessly. We've done this New Yorker for the past 14 months or whatever it is, out of apartments. And God willing, that'll come to an end. We'll meet again in an office probably in September. But I'm really, really, really proud of, as I'm sure so many people on this call are, of their own staffs, of our writers, our editors, and our everybody, the fact checkers, everybody who works at The New Yorker. It's been a hell on wheels for people. It's been terrible. People have suffered personal tragedies and in myriad ways. And also suffering the great wounds of what we've witnessed politically. It's a lot. It's a lot for the soul to bear.
How do you think all of that is changing journalism going forward?
Well, I hardly need tell you that our business is changing radically and in many ways not for the better. One of my biggest concerns is, I live in New York City. And I'm blessed with certainly, if not the greatest newspaper in the world, and the one of the very top newspapers. But there are a lot of big cities in this country that don't have that any longer. Either these papers have gone out of business, or they're so reduced by the circumstances that we all know that for example, I grew up in New Jersey, across the river from where I'm sitting now. And the Newark Star-Ledger was an awfully, you know, wasn't a perfect paper, didn't pretend to be the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal, but as an aggressive local paper, it was quite good. And every mayor of Newark, when I was growing up, went to jail. For one form of corruption or another, like four of them, I think. Five. I forget what the number is. Now, how did that happen? Well, at least part of that is aggressive local journalism in a sizable place. Newark is not a tiny town. And places like that, and so who's going to send the corrupt judge in Akron, Ohio to jail? Or begin the process of discovering what it means to have a discriminatory housing policy in El Paso. Who's doing that? If journalism is shrinking for all the economic factors we know all too well, I hardly need for this audience to go through it. And for all their faults, the old ownerships are drifting away, and the new owners are private equity firms that really want to, you know, use newspapers as a way to get some quick profit and then go away. And they haven't, and these institutions have not been replaced by their digital progeny that are good and aggressive and well funded. That is a difficulty for American democracy. And I have no doubt that you're experiencing similar things, and that's happening all over the world. And so I think part of democratic decline, imperilment, is not, everything cannot be Donald Trump. Donald Trump is exploited these things to his advantage in ways that we can discuss. But I'm quite concerned about the state of the press right now. Not that there aren't wonderful journalists, not that there aren't wonderful institutions and people working despite all kinds of disadvantages. And I know how lucky I am. I really do. But, you know, luck has run out for a lot of other institutions.
It's a really good point, isn't it? I mean, so much of big journalistic pieces that are interesting to people like across a country or a continent or the world start off as a local story. And if you don't have that thread to even follow, how do we even know? And how do we get accountability? Sure. I remember reading in The New Yorker a couple of years ago, those stories of corrupt sheriffs who, when people wouldn't pay bail, or they'd pick it up on like parking tickets, and they would take away their homes. They would take away all of their material possessions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had not heard about that in the US until I read it in The New Yorker. Because if it was happening, it's a really hard thing for a local reporter to dive deep in and find out about and actually, you know, lawyer up on too.
It's expensive. To unleash a reporter, a writer, to pay them a decent salary, health insurance, or, you know, and say, you don't have to have this in a week's time, but you can have as long as it takes to get the story. That's expensive. That's expensive. And there are countless stories that require scrutiny. You know, The New Yorker on the website, Charles Bethay, had a piece a few months ago about the last environmental reporter at a small newspaper in West Virginia, Coal Country. He lost his job. Who's covering that? Who's covering that? Has social media filled the gap? I doubt it. Social media has its uses and its abuses, but I don't think investigative journalism is something that is can be filled by that in any way that I've seen yet. Who knows?
Do you see any kind of movement amongst those who are the decision makers or the deep pockets in trying to fix up? Because I think that you certainly would have a lot of journalists who would be more than happy to take on those roles, that they don't necessarily have to run and be a foreign correspondent. They would love to keep digging in their backyard in their own.
Yeah, there are new institutions that use different funding models, like ProPublica, the Marshall Project, which is about criminal justice in the United States, and other things that are exciting, interesting, do good work, win awards, and so on. But has it filled the gap of all that's gone out of our journalistic ecology? I don't think so. I don't think so. And, you know, there have been all kinds of discussions about should universities underfund it? What other models other than this traditional either state or privately held corporate models would there be? You know, and there are some aggressive small publications too, but they are small. And or they're ideological, and that can serve a purpose too. But reporting, the thing that we're talking about, requires time, requires expense, requires skill and experience. And I'm concerned about that.
I want to ask you about objectivity, because we're, of course, in the midst of an important discussion around that and the prism through which stories are framed
right.
and pursued. What's your thinking? What have you been thinking through this discussion?
You mean about opinion and
well, and objectivity and the issue of, you know, a predominantly white journalistic workforce ignoring.
Well, I think those are perhaps two different issues. One is diversity, which I think is absolutely essential at any journalistic institution worthy of its name. And, you know, and some aspects of diversity have come before others. You know, The New Yorker is, I think our staff is 65% women. But at the same time, we have a number of excellent Black writers and editors, senior editors too. And we need to do better on other areas though. For example, this is a country that I don't know what the exact numbers are, but it's, I think maybe as much as 20% is Hispanic, is Latino, excuse me. And we don't have an adequate number of voices from that extremely varied community or set of communities in the United States, and we need to do better. So that's a question of diversity. And look, do I think you absolutely have to have a writer of X group write about that group at all times? No, I do not. But I do know that, you know, over time, it matters to have, you know, diversity in your newsroom as editors, as writers, and elsewhere. The first part of your question, though, was about what?
About objectivity. And you
so
know,
objectivity
those...
to me, they're related. Okay. They're not unrelated. You're right. But I guess, you know, and I grew up at the Washington Post, which is a very straight, excellent newspaper. I prefer the word fairness to objectivity. I mean, when I think about objectivity, I think of scientific method and a kind of perfectibility of result. But I don't think journalism can achieve that. What it can achieve is fairness and some sense of balance, perspective, and context. Now, at The New Yorker, writers do have points of view, but they have to kind of earn them. Do you know what I mean? They can't just, I'll clean up the metaphor, but it used to be said that having an opinion is like salt shakers. Everybody has one. And you know, opinions can be interesting and they can be convincingly expressed and maybe change or push your own point of view. That's great. But I do think what's even more essential, at least in our publication, is the marshaling of a fact and being fair, precisely what, you know, I find a lot of cable television doesn't do. We don't have to have the predictable conversation about Fox TV. It's too boring and predictable at this point. But I know that people think of The New Yorker as a liberal magazine in many ways, but there are differing views. But I'm not here to publish the National Review either.
Right.
Let the National Review do that, and you know, all the power to them.
Now, and I'm interested also just to tease out a little bit when we talk about objectivity. And yes, that's objectivity, subjectivity is kind of, I agree with you, the fairness moniker is important, but right. but we are, you know, in my own work, even, you know, when I've worked with journalists coming up and, you know, I don't think that there are a number of journalists who have pointed out, and they're not wrong, that a journalist who is, for example, of Arab descent, when they do a story about Palestinians and, you know, the Arab-Israeli conflict, they get questioned a little more. A Black journalist raising an issue. And I'm not talking about one specific publication.
I'm sure that that's true. But, I'm sure that's in the breach true.
Yeah. So the prism through which we inevitably frame a story, right?
Inevitably. But that's why I don't know that objectivity in its purest scientific sense of the word is achievable or even what we should be asking of ourselves. I think it's imperative on all of us. You know, let's take the Middle East, for example. And I think what you're referring to when you say the Middle East, you're talking about the Arab-Israeli conflict.
In this context, yes.
Yeah.
I know it's bigger.
It's immensely complicated. Yeah. It's a long history. It's not just about which rockets were fired at whom this morning. And each side has very complicated narratives of its own, and they're not single narratives either. Not all Israeli Jews think the same thing any more than all Palestinian Arabs think the same thing. I think the smartest thing a human being can do, much less a journalist, is acknowledge, not throw up one's hands, but acknowledge the immense complexity of everything from the Middle East conflict to, you know, pick your subject. I'm not suggesting that each side is equally right or wrong. I'm not suggesting that the let's be fair to the Ku Klux Klan, because after all, it's not a reductio ad absurdum, but it is worth knowing more than knowing less. It is worth providing more context than less context. It is worth journalists always questioning their presumptions.
Did you always want to be a journalist?
No, I wanted to write fiction. And I'm sure that that's pretty old style, early ambition of a lot of people I've got on this call. My parents were sick. I grew up in a family with two disabled parents. And there was just no way that I had the financial latitude of setting out and being a creative artist, you know, on my own. I didn't have I didn't have the confidence to do so. And so in my own twisted imagination, the compromise was to get into the newspaper game.
Who inspired you?
To be a journalist. I mean, this wasn't early on, but I mean, like a lot of people who eventually became foreign correspondents, I read Orwell with absolute reverence. His book on the Spanish Civil War, his work on poverty, his essays, the clarity of his prose, and the heterodoxy of his thinking is to me heroic. But that came later.
Well, and you know, you first came on my radar as the Moscow correspondent at a time of great upheaval in the former Soviet Union and the Eastern European countries. I'm just wondering, what did you learn then that you were able to take forward?
Everything. I learned how to be a reporter in Moscow. I was only 29 years old, and I had been a kind of feature writer and a sports writer. I did whatever the Washington Post sent me to do, and I had a lot of fun. But I think the depth of my work, you know, I skipped from, you know, if you're a feature writer, you skip from lily pad to lily pad in a way. Moscow is where I grew up. That's where I grew up. And I was sent there as, the Washington Post had one person in Moscow, you know, kind of the responsible adult who knew how to write about arms control and U.S.-Soviet relations and so on. And they decided they were going to become more expansive and have a second correspondent in a landmass that, you know, covers 10 time zones. So my wife and I, quite young at the time, moved there. my wife Esther Fine, and she wrote for the New York Times, and I wrote for the Washington Post. It was like, you know, Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And we worked from, you know, 9 a.m. till 2 a.m. every day for 4 years. It was journalistic heaven. And you were writing about everything, but you were thinking about this one big subject all the time. And I just learned a tremendous amount, and not just about Russian life or Russian politics, but about news writing, about getting things right, about everything that I needed to know. And it was kind of trial by fire.
And, you know, at that time in the Soviet Union, there was also a reckoning of truth and versus
That's
propaganda.
Right.
You write about that in the
That's right.
book you won a Pulitzer Prize for.
The mistakes happen.
Fast forward, and you're in the United States, and there's a reckoning on truth and propaganda and what's real and who won an election
That's a very good point. The phrase enemies of the people, vrag narodov, as they say in Russian. Well, that was used in the French Revolution during the terror. And then it was used by Stalin to identify his enemies. And I think we know what happened to those enemies. To hear an American president refer to the press as enemies of the people is something so mind-boggling and disgusting that it just beggars the imagination. On the other hand, there were so many other horrible things done and said in those 4 years that we barely remember it. We barely remember it. This is an administration framed by an inauguration in which the president not only lied about the crowd, which seems half funny at this point, but also gave a speech that could have come out of the mouth of an autocrat anywhere in the world. And then its last days were framed by an uprising on the U.S. Capitol, inspired by a president who denied the legitimacy of an American election. So a lot of water went under the decrepit bridge in those 4 years. And one of those moments was the oft-repeated enemies of the people. But the implications of what that was about should not be forgotten, because I don't think it's gone away. I think he was very successful in deepening mistrust of you, of me, of everybody on this call, and it probably extended beyond our national borders, and it infected the rhetoric of many leaders who were not American. You saw it in Brazil, you saw it in Hungary, you saw it. These people were only too glad to have the endorsement of an American president. And its results were horrific.
I have questions from the audience that I want to ask
Sure.
you as well. But before I get there, you have made the point, talking about the erosion of politics, that you've reminded people that Donald Trump was always signaling who he really was. And
I don't think he was hiding in plain sight.
So who's hiding in plain sight now that journalists need to pay attention to, that they need to see those signals?
Well, the event of the week in American politics, at least, is Liz Cheney. Well, I'm no fan of her politics, but that's over here, or to say nothing of Dick Cheney. But when someone is thrown out of the leadership of the party because she refuses to echo the preposterous lie that the president of the United States was not elected legitimately, then that is a very worrying thing. And this is after the Trump administration. This is a party that continues to bow and scrape to not only a neo-authoritarian and a racist, but also someone who is in the business of defying the hand in front of your face. And it's endorsed as a requirement of good standing in the Republican Party. Now, again, my politics aside, this was not always the case in the Republican Party, which used to have a fairly wide ideological spectrum. Again, not be my cup of tea, but who cares? This is a radical and worrying turn in American life. And it's not going to disappear very easily if it disappears at all.
Which brings us right back to the need for good journalism. And, you know, several people have sent in questions that have made it very clear that they would like to work for you. They aspire to see their work in The New Yorker.
That's very kind.
What should they be thinking about to get there? What are you looking for in new writers?
Wow. Energy, obsession, talent, skill. You know, I don't mean to be dismissive of the question. I'm answering earnestly. And, you know, one of the greatest writers we ever had in fiction is Alice Munro. And, you know, right now, one of our leading critics, I'm just thinking of Canadians, is Adam Gopnik. So what does Adam Gopnik bring to the table? Damn near everything. An incredible range of obsessions and interests. And even though he's, I'm proud to say, maybe even a year or two older than me, which is really saying something, he is no less enthusiastic and obsessed with his work and its quality than when he was, you know, 30. So it's probably asking too much, but sometimes you're lucky enough to get it.
I have a question from Peter German, who wants to know if you ever needed a cartoon to be explained to you before publishing it.
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, you've passed a certain age when that happens. It's like popular music. And because everybody's got a frame of reference. Just as old people find themselves rolling their eyes and explaining, you know, something about the Beatles to somebody who's, you know, 15, the opposite happens. And we ought to have the modesty to know that that's part of life. So sure.
I have a question here from Cindy McCammon. You touched on this because of the book you're releasing with Jelani Cobb, but has the current conversation about systemic racism and discrimination made you revisit New Yorker history to see if you need to address anything? And how do you deal with this issue when any larger media organization might feel there is a ticking time bomb in its archives?
Well, look, I think that we're all sensible enough, modest enough to know that the way we think about any subject now is likely to not be the way that we think about it before. Whether, you know, there were precious few, even when I got to the New Yorker 25 years ago, there were very, very few Black writers there. So things change. And I think the process of, you know, spending all your time toppling, you know, time bombs in one's archive, it's there. If I look at cartoons from the 30s, there are things that are just sexist or racist, or you just wouldn't publish them now. The real problem is if you're continuing to be blind to this. You do what you can. You hire more diversely. That's an awkward sentence, but you know what I mean. You question yourself. You do better. That's the very definition of what we should be after. You bring in, of course you question yourself. What would we be without it? We'd be fools and worse. So, yeah.
I'm watching the clock. We have to wrap up there. But David, thank you so much for your time and for your work and for your leadership.
My pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for collecting around the hearth of the computer screen. And I hope one day we'll all be in the same room. I think it'll be soon.
Thanks again.
Take care.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us. This wraps up our season of J-Talks. The Canadian Journalism Foundation has a special presentation, however, coming up, and Natalie alluded to it. And we hope you're going to tune in to watch that. The CJF is honoring two health journalists with the CJF Tribute Award with their exceptional impact throughout their careers, and especially during this COVID-19 pandemic. You're likely familiar with the honorees, Andre Picard, health reporter and columnist for the Globe and Mail, and Dr. Sanjay Gupta, chief medical correspondent for CNN. As last year's tribute honoree, I'm looking forward to having back-to-back conversations with both of them about covering this pandemic and about the books they each released earlier this year and about what they're thinking and how they are thinking about all of the kind of reporting they do moving forward. To register for this talk on June 10th, just visit the website, CJF website. And to stay updated on all CJF events, visit the website to sign up for the newsletter or follow the Canadian Journalism Foundation on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram. A reminder, you can find the videos and the podcasts of past talks on the CJF website as well. We've had some great conversations this season. Thank you for all of your questions and for all of your time in being part of this. Thanks for watching.